But tonight, it is my great pleasure to welcome to our Many Rivers community, Mr. Luis Minero, author of, and I don't, do you mind if I,
by all means.
I didn't grab copy, my own copy. Author of this wonderful book, Demystifying the Out-of-Body Experience, a Practical Manual for Exploration and Personal Evolution. I've been reading it myself, I've been very impressed. Those of you who read the email that I sent out as notice will have seen my testimonial to that. And I want to also mention that Mr. Minero graduated with honors from Florida International University, has taught courses on out-of-body experiences, paranormal phenomena, and spiritual growth at Miami-Dade College. He's the executive director of the California branch of the International Academy of Consciousness and the education director of that organization globally. And we are delighted that he could join us here to talk about his brand new book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rom, and thank you for the opportunity, of course. Thank you all in advance, you know, for this evening, for the opportunity to share these ideas. Something even that sometimes I like to start out with is us, the work that we do, and even I'll talk a little bit more about the Academy of Consciousness. We are all really volunteers all over the world, so we do this because we see the benefit that it comes to people, and we like to share this information with all of you. So because of this, you know, already thank you for the opportunity and for the, you know, that time that we're going to be sharing here, yeah? But first of all, I guess starting a little more and just saying a couple of things about myself. I know Rob was already introducing me. With regards to the out-of-body experience, I started having them when I was 12. Spontaneously, voluntarily, I didn't know that there was a name, that there were techniques, that other people had them, or if everybody had them. I just simply had them and thought that they were, I guess when I was 12, probably I thought that they were cool. You know, I don't even know what I thought about them. But they were so obvious that I was aware, conscious, outside my body. But you know, the mentality of a 12-year-old boy, probably after that, somebody called me to go play soccer, and you know, that was it. My mind was in something else. I was in another dimension already. After that, I kept on having them maybe about once a year or so, more or less. It wasn't really a very big frequency. But it wasn't until I was maybe 17 or so that I read the first book on out-of-body experiences. And I realized that there were techniques that actually people had already, you know, written quite a bit about the experience and everything. And finally, when I found, you know, this institution and my colleagues, my friends, I realized that they really have done a lot of homework with regards to the OBE. And of course, my abilities, my capacities increased. And as Rob was mentioning, for more or less 70 years, 18 years or so, I've been giving classes all over the world on out-of-body experiences, and I had the fortune of learning a few languages, so, you know, already in Europe, South America, here, all over the U.S., you know, and I have seen a lot of individuals that sometimes have read a lot about OBEs or have had already a lot of experiences, and they come to the classes and they learn to control them better, well, and also I've seen people that they arrive at our classes sometimes even because they were dragged in there by the person sitting next to them. And they had never read anything about it. They just simply, you know, didn't want to disappoint their partner to a certain extent. Certainly I've seen a lot of cases like that. But they, you know, dedicated the time, started, you know, training themselves, and really almost like a sport, the capacity started developing. They, you know, ended up having, you know, their own out-of-body experiences. So I've seen, you know, all kinds of individuals, all kinds of, you know, how could I say, ages, social strata, education, background, etc., etc., etc. Yeah? Now, talking a little bit more, maybe first of all, to give you a little bit of a better context of all of this, of who we are, you know, the organization that I'm a part of, you know, the IAC, we're an International Academy of Consciousness, really we're a non-profit organization of research of education. So our main objective is to compile as much information as we can on these topics, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, vital energies, spiritual evolutions, evolution, consciousness development, etc., and pass this on to interested individuals. We have already been doing this for a little bit over 20 years, and you know, we do it all over the world. Sometimes I joke that if you can read the names of the cities here, you already have some clairvoyance. I don't know who picks these colors, you know, the corporate office, but even for me, it's hard to read this, you know, up close. And I know my graduation is not that bad. So So, but anyways, we give classes all over the world, here in the U.S., here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and in Los Angeles, in New York, in Miami, Houston, Austin, Philadelphia, etc., etc., etc. In other parts of the world, all over Europe, in Australia, South America, etc., etc. This, more than anything, I mention it just to give you an idea of the size of the institution. I would say probably in the entire world, we must be about maybe about 300 to 500 researchers more dedicated, you know, to the study of all of these topics. Most of my coworkers, most of my colleagues, I should say, more than coworkers, were all volunteers, really. So I don't know if I could use the word coworkers, but most of them, they are psychologists. They are doctors, really, most of them. But there are scientists of all kinds, physicists, chemists, biologists, sociologists, etc., etc., etc. And also, I always like to point this out, maybe a smaller percentage of my colleagues, but still maybe a 5-10%, a good amount, they don't necessarily have a college degree, but they have a lot of experience with all of this phenomena, and they contribute with all of this experience. And of course, this is more than welcome, by all means. Yeah, so trying to give you an idea of the institution as a whole. Our headquarters are actually located in Portugal, where we have like a university campus with laboratories, and a lot of the research actually takes place over there. Maybe not all of this is completely built, and maybe the most interesting thing for participants at the beginning are these little white balls that you see here, or these little white spheres, that they are individual laboratories for producing different paranormal phenomena. So the people goes in there, you know, produces an energetic phenomena or an out-of-body experience, for example. Especially in this one here in the middle, that I don't know how many of you have eagle vision, and you can read this over here, Projectarium, which would be the specialized laboratory for producing projections outside the body. Out-of-body experience, unfolding, mystic voyage, astral travel. I don't know what might be the name that might be more common, you know, for you. This lab, the way it looks, and I'll apologize for the science fiction references. If you saw the movie X-Men, and probably several of you did, you're going to remember this spheric structure that Professor Xavier used to go in and, you know, put on a helmet and access mutants all over the world. I won't tell you the whole movie, I promise, but you probably remember this structure. When we saw that movie, I remember we thought, look, these guys from Hollywood stole our idea, because this is exactly the Projectarium. Now, that in the movie, of course, is science fiction, right? That doesn't quite exist, I wish, but it doesn't. Now, the Projectarium does. We have had it in operation already for many years, and hundreds, thousands of experiments have already been conducted there. And of course, as people go there, as we go there, and you know, we do also our own experiments, we're trying to understand better how the phenomena works. All the variables that go into that. For example, is it easier to have out-of-body experiences for men or for women? For younger people or for older? If the person took a vitamin, a supplement, a medication, does that help or does that hinder? Which technique did they use? You know, which one seems to be more, you know, effective? So everything that pertains to the ability, you know, we're trying there to register. And part of this information, of course, is what we use, you know, all over the world in the classes. Really, I'm showing this for you at the beginning, just for you to get an idea at least of one of our research lines, one of them. Because like this, there are many, 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 many. Really, what we're trying to do every time is trying to understand more or better, you know, all of these capacities. Yeah, so just to give you an idea at least of one. Now, since we are here in the official presentations, and we always start out with this, even in my book, I actually start out saying this. In the lectures, I always say, and we say, don't believe in anything, not even in what we are saying here, but experiment, have your own experiences. In the book, of course, I say, don't believe in what is written here, but experiment, have your own experiences. And part of the reason why we start with this phrase that sounds a little contradictory, right? Somebody starting already telling you, look, don't believe in this. Really, the intention for this is because, first of all, we are not an institution that is based on belief. If you understand what I mean, really there is nothing that needs to be just simply accepted or believed in, not at all. As a matter of fact, something I was telling is that, you know, I want to go through this presentation, give you a lot of ideas here during these 40, 50 minutes, and then I want to leave a good, at least 20 minutes for a Q&A, and feel free to ask, you know, whatever you want, believe me, it's allowed, let's put it this way. So you can question, you can debate, it's no problem. Sometimes also I mention, when I am in bookstores like this, it's a pleasure to give these presentations because I am with people that normally are interested in that topic and they want to learn, for example. But also sometimes I give conferences in universities to college professors. And they don't necessarily have the same intention that you have, if you already understand what I mean. Sometimes they're trying more to test you, to see where are the holes, and to a certain extent, even because this information and this phenomena as a whole sometimes threatens them a little bit and threatens their paradigms to a very great extent. So those types of lectures usually go a very different route, let's put it this way. We many times agree to disagree, let's put it this way. And look, I'm a chemist. I spent years in university doing research in chemistry and had very interesting discussions, just let me name them that, with my colleagues and the conventional scientists and everything. But of course, something that they are missing, and this is part of the intention with this phrase, is their own experience. Because what happens is that sometimes it's very hard to produce a physical proof of something that goes beyond the physical reality. Yeah, there are certain ways in which we can confirm this, and I'll talk about it. But, trying to put it in a more conventional setting in terms of instrumentalism is extremely, extremely hard. So, of course, one of the best ways for people to corroborate, to prove, to verify that these realities are so, is for them to have their own experiences. And in the book, in our classes also, since we give classes all over the world, in our classes and in the book, the intention is precisely this, to try to give as much information so that the person develops its own experiences without any type of indoctrination or attachment, you know what I mean, or gurulatry, if you understand what I mean, or have to keep coming back every month for some session or tweaking of some sort. No, we usually say that this is a capacity almost like learning how to read. So at some moment in our life, we dedicated some time, right? We learned the capacity, and now this gives us a lot of freedom. We can, you know, just simply choose which book we want to read, and, you know, we don't have to pay taxes for having the capacity, or we don't have to go back to second grade a few months just to refresh the ABCs. It's unnecessary. Now we have the capacity. So this type of freedom is the one that we wish everybody could have, you know, once they start having their own experiences. Yeah. Also, of course, something that is implicit in this is so that the person stays, I guess, a little bit more sharp, sort of like with a question in mind. Because again, by all means, you can ask and question, you know, whatever you want. This is perfectly fine. No problem. Okay. We actually keep it permanently wherever we give classes. Now, besides this, since we are also here in the official presentations, let me begin by, first of all, talking about the main two subjects that we focus on, this small little pocketbook, as we joke, right? I don't know in which pocket it'll fit. But this, first of all, is the textbook of the formal study projectology, or projections outside the body. So you can see it's quite a volume. And a good friend of ours, doctor, you know, he wrote this book and proposed this this study. And basically what it studies is everything that pertains to the out-of-body experience. One of the biggest merits that he has is he had out-of-body experiences since he was 9, I believe, and he realized probably something that we all notice. Most religions, most cultures, most lines of thinking, philosophies all over the world know about the out-of-body experience. Sometimes they know a little bit, but they know about it. Some maybe know a little bit more. But it seems to a certain extent as if the information is scattered all over the world. So he decided to spend about 20, 30 years of his life going about the world, collecting all of these pieces of the puzzle, if you will, to try to put the puzzle together. By no means is the puzzle complete. We don't understand everything, certainly not. But you get a much better idea of how this works and what are the more effective ways of developing, etc., etc., you know, once you start comparing all of this information. So this is the culmination of about 20, 30 years of his life, and after him come all of these other 300 to 500 researchers who we have kept on adding material to the pot. Yeah? So this is one, projectology. The study of, you know, the ability, the phenomenon, so to speak. That, believe it or not, is English. I know it doesn't look like it, but it is. This one is not English. This is Portuguese. This is the second subject that we focus more on. And actually, the word in Portuguese is not that different from our English. It's conscienciology. Conscienciology would be the study of the consciousness. What we mean by the consciousness is not only the state of being alert or aware, but when we especially use the article and we say the consciousness, what we're trying to refer to is to the essence that we are, to the intelligent principle that we are independent of the physical body. So if somebody were to ask you on the street, what are we in essence? Probably the two most common names that we would, you know, use to refer to our essence is we would say, I am a soul or I am a spirit. Yeah, obviously there are a few other names, but probably this is what most people would say. So a synonym of a soul or a spirit would be the consciousness, where actually the name of the institution comes from. And the study of the consciousness is conscienciology. Yeah? So it would be like saying, you know, the story of the spirit. I don't know if this play on words is going to help you more or confuse you more, but conscienciology would be like saying spiritology, the story of the spirit. Yeah? I know you understand this definition, but look, even I that have been, you know, studying this and giving classes and conferences for a while, sometimes I hear this definition and it sounds to me so abstract, so philosophical, the story of the soul. What I mean to say is, if we put our feet on the ground and we think about it for a second, we start to think, look, how does one go about studying the soul? What kind of an experiment could we make, you know, to try to understand better the soul or the spirit? And this gentleman here, you know, I know maybe most of you don't read Portuguese, but you can probably make it out. He's suggesting 700 experiments of conscienciology. So how can this be? Now, I know it sounds abstract and philosophical, but it isn't at all, actually. It's something very specific, direct, straightforward. And let me see if I can help you with this. Actually, by having the out-of-body experience, we can start to observe us and souls in our native habitat, so to speak. And then this helps us to start to understand more directly and more specifically, you know, souls in general. Yeah? You see, if I can start also, maybe use this approach. All of us, we have been living in this physical reality and using this physical body, right, for many decades. And we have observed the physical reality and we understand it very well. So we know about economy, about politics, about geographical divisions, about our FICO score that, you know, we are fighting there to keep it up, right? So all of the, you know, physical things that we, you know, that is part of the package of being the physical reality to a certain extent. So we know about this. Great. But what happens the moment that we start having out-of-body experiences and we are able, for example, to observe individuals, souls, that are not at this moment inside a physical body like us and who don't have to worry about transportation, insurance, credit, politics? What do they do? Can you see how having out-of-body experiences allows us to observe this very directly? And again, it has nothing to do with philosophy or, you know, abstract thought, but it's almost like sociology, like going and studying, you know, a culture in Australia or in Africa, that we can go and very directly observe and take notes and, you know, how could I say, arrive at consensus as other people are also having the experiences. And this helps us to understand better, you know, the soul, us at the same time. Yeah, does this make sense? Look, let me see if I can also use this approach. I don't know, by the way, what is the extent of your out-of-body experiences. Maybe some of you already had a lot. Maybe some of you already read a lot. And again, as I was joking, maybe some of you are here because you were dragged in here by the person sitting next to you. If this is the case, welcome. By the way, we won't discriminate. But maybe you have read or maybe you have had OBEs, and you know that when you have an out-of-body experience, sometimes you can go very far. You can travel very big distances, you know, in a short time. Sometimes we can even have, skip this a little bit, sometimes we can even have experiences, you know, outside the planet. These ones are called of exoprojections. And the interesting thing about these experiences is that they are not the most interesting, that they are also not the hardest ones. I know that they sound, or that they look grandiose, I don't know what adjective to use, especially compared, you know, to the monotony here of the physical reality. But really my point by putting them here is just to show you that this is feasible. This is actually not that difficult. A lot of people sometimes that have spontaneous involuntary experiences, they find themselves just floating out into space very quickly without too much control to a certain extent and having these experiences. Because the first time maybe we look a little bit like, have you seen how when babies are starting to walk, that they are not able to control well their sense of direction and they want to get to their mother and they arrive at the other end of the living room? Sometimes we look a little bit like that and we are, you know, surfing outside the planet. This is really not that difficult and not the most interesting. There are things a lot more interesting. I'll get to that in a second. But just to understand a little bit better here, conscientiology. Let's assume that all of us, we have an out-of-body experience tonight. And let's say that we don't go that far. Let's say that we don't even go to the 7-Eleven in the corner, okay? So I'm trying to simplify things a little bit more. Let's say that we leave the body and we stay within our bedroom. So certainly a much more simpler type of out-of-body experience compared to everything else that we could, you know, experience. The first thing is, if we are floating there about our bedroom and we are in a classical, typical out-of-body experience, the first thing we're going to realize is that we are aware, conscious, that this is nothing like a dream, which, by the way, is a very common question. What is the difference between a dream and an out-of-body experience? The difference is really the level of awareness. You know, how clear in terms of our thinking, our internal processes, our perceptions we are when we are outside the body versus the dream. Really, just relying on your own experience and trying to help with this distinction, if I were to ask you right now, at this moment, are you dreaming this presentation or are you aware, awake of this presentation? I am sure, right? I hope. I hope that all of you are going to tell me that you are aware. Sometimes I joke and I say, I know that usually takes me half an hour to put people to sleep. So I know at this moment, you're still following. Yeah, you are aware. But, you know, jokes aside, neither one of you needs to pinch yourselves. You know that you are aware. You know that you are awake. And if you compare this condition that you're in right now with dreaming, you realize that it's very different from a dream. In this same condition that you are right now, you find yourself when you're in a classical, typical out-of-body experience. Completely aware, with all of your memories, with all of your bad jokes and good jokes, it's you, you know, it's your personality. Just to give you a few details, let's think about this a little bit more. How many times when you are dreaming, for example, or how many times are we able to remember when we are dreaming our address, our phone number? In dreams, I have never remembered them. But in out-of-body experiences, you do. You remember this very clearly, just like you are right now, meaning your internal process are working very, very well. And you can give, by the way, your phone number if you want to somebody else, and they can call you the next day. It's no problem. So it's a very different condition from a dream. It's just simply the level of awareness is just like right now, like at this moment right now. Yeah?
Did you just clarify for me what the difference is between out-of-body experiences or, for example, if I'm journeying, because I do shamanic work, so if I'm journeying,
yeah,
going to a different realm or a different dimension, is that what you're calling out-of-body experience, or do you have a specific, a different definition?
It's because I don't know specifically what is it that is happening in your experience, but when
you
have
when
you have an out-of-body experience, and actually I was getting to this, but when you have an out-of-body experience, you can certainly visit a lot of different realms, a lot of different, you know, dimensions and realities, etc., etc. So, but even then, they're all out-of-body experiences. I know that sometimes people may classify them differently depending on where they go, but at the end, you know, it's basically we are going out with the so-called astral body. We are out, we are visiting different places. Sometimes something interesting, and I don't know if it might have happened to you, sometimes in some of my experiences it occurs, and I know authors that this happens to them, or that happened to them all the time, is that sometimes we don't even see our astral body because we are focusing on what we're doing. And I know of authors that they have written, and you know, for everything that you see in their life, and afterwards they pass away, they never saw their astral body, simply because they were not looking for them. It's not as obvious as in the physical reality. To a certain extent, our senses outside the body are determined by our will, by our focus, by our concentration. So if I focus on something that is very interesting, I'm basically only seeing that outside the body and not, you know, everything else that I would catch in my peripheral vision with the physical eyes. Yeah? So normally the out-of-body experience happens when the person is sleeping or dreaming, you know, normally. Then we disconnect from the body. We are able to recover the awareness. We can recover it for, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or sometimes it only lasts maybe 10 seconds or so. The idea, of course, is to learn to control it so that this can last a lot longer. And then we can go and fly and have experiences and learn in a lot of different realms. And then we come back and we are able to download, let's say, the information here into the physical brain. Yeah. So this would be a classical type of out-of-body experience. But the, how could I say, the variety of experiences that we can have are enormous. And I'll get to that in a second. So look, we are there in our bedroom. Maybe we have the opportunity to turn around and look at our physical body in bed, sleeping. I don't know how many of you have already had this. If you haven't had this, something more or less like this, I don't know if you can imagine at this moment what your reaction will be the first time that you are outside the body, looking at your physical body in bed, sleeping. This is interesting. To a certain extent, it shouldn't surprise us. To a certain extent, it shouldn't scare us, even though I know it does. In the practice, you know, that's one of the most common reactions at first. But, and it shouldn't surprise us because I am sure that probably all of you would agree with me when we say that we know that we are more than the physical body. We understand, we agree that we are more than the physical body. But see how we are sometimes very, I don't know what word to use, maybe paradoxical. In the sense that even though we know we are more than the physical body, we live this life as if we were only this physical body. We take decisions as if we were only this physical body. Part of that is because, of course, many times most people are relying on, you know, when they take their decisions and they do actions, they're relying on the references and on the memories that they have in their head, which are mainly physical, of course. And this is one of the things that are interesting about the out-of-body experience. That the moment that we have out-of-body experiences, we realize more in the practice, I am more than the physical body. I exist beyond the physical body. So let me even give you some ideas to think about. Let me focus on me so that the energies follow me. So I have done this many times already over the years. I can be there looking at my physical body in bed, sleeping, snoring a little bit more than I would like to admit, but you know, the physical body, just the normal physical body. Now, when I am seeing my body there, my body happens to have a name, just like all of you have your own specific name. Mine just happens to be Luis Minero. And then I identify myself with this name. When somebody says Luis, you know, I'm the one that says I didn't do it, or something of that nature. Yeah? So, but anyways, that's me. And, you know, there are a lot of other things that identify my physical body, you know, passport number, social security number, my relationship. Sometimes they say, who is that guy? Ah, he's the brother of Sandra. Ah, then I know who he is. I remember him. Yeah? So we identify ourselves by our relationships. But in this very simple out-of-body experience, I realize I am much more than Luis Minero. Much more. The entire reality Luis Minero certainly is a part of me. It's a fraction. It's an aspect of me. But it's not all of what I am. So then the question is, if I am not what I have been used to all my life, then who am I? What am I? Because I was never Luis Minero. This is just an aspect of me. And then I realized that in an out-of-body experience, I can gather information that is going to help me to answer more deeply for me, more than anything, not necessarily for anybody else, you know, this old question of the philosophy. Who am I? Yeah. By the same token, in the practice, I realize I am here existing independently of the physical body. So it means that in a few decades, when the physical body has too many miles and there are no spare parts, you know, to, how could I say, to put here in this biological car, and it passes away, I will continue existing, and I don't necessarily need to have any fear or trauma because of this transition. So I verify in the practice that I survive physical death. And then I realize that in an out-of-body experience, once I, either before I was born or after I pass away, I am going to be in these states or in these dimensions or in these planes where I am in right now. So I can start to investigate these types of planes or realms. For example, let me see if I can make a very specific question so that it's clear. At this moment, I have the physical tool that helps me to interact with the physical reality. but my soul, my consciousness, my essence existed before the physical body was formed. So then I could think, 2 years before I was born, when I didn't have the physical tool, where was I? With whom? Doing what? And then I realized that in an out-of-body experience, I can go investigate or research which was the plane or the dimension or the reality where I was, and also gather information that is going to help me to understand, especially for me, you know, also this whole question of the philosophy. Where do I come from? What do we usually answer when people ask us where do we come from? We usually give them a physical reference, right? Because this is probably what they're expecting, you know. If I say dimension X, they're going to look at me like, you know, ooh, ooh. But, you know, now I can have a much deeper answer for myself. And by the same token, this works, you know, towards the future. When the physical body passes away, I'm going to be back again in these astral or spiritual planes. And then in an out-of-body experience, I can get an understanding of where is it that I am going to go. And then come back and continue living my life without necessarily any trauma because of this transition. Yeah? Now, something maybe even more, how could I say, more day-to-day stuff, more practical. I am there looking at my physical body and I realize I am not a physical body. However, every day of my life, I am inside of it, wearing it, using it, you know, wearing this big gorilla here that I have been given, you know, to go through the human existence. And then the question would be, if I am not a physical body, why do I have one? Could it be that there is a reason or a cause, you know, an objective? People like to call this sometimes popularly of a life mission or a life task. Could it be that there is such a thing? What I can tell you that what we see is that there are several dimensions there where individuals intelligently, before being born, this is the places where they are planning their main tasks or projects or realizations that they want to accomplish in the physical reality. And then we realize that in an out-of-body experience, I can go and get, like an understanding of what was my initial intention for coming into this physical life in the first place. What is my life purpose? In other words, yeah? Now, just to summarize a little bit all of this and not to keep on going only with this example. Notice I was giving this example just to explain a little bit better conscientiology. So see how all of these ideas that I would say are very fundamental, that they go very much to the core of what we understand reality to be, can come to us on what we were calling at the beginning a very simple experience. We really haven't left the bedroom yet. So something that we could consider is, what is the potential for growth, for developing, for experiencing the moment that we start leaving the bedroom in out-of-body experiences? The potential is huge, of course, and not because somebody's going to be telling you how it goes. You know, somebody's going to be up here telling you, look, do A, B, C, D. No, it's because now instead of somebody reading something to you, now you know how to read. So you can read it directly. You can experience it directly, is what I mean, yeah? This is conscientiology. So using the out-of-body experience, you know, we can start having these direct observations, you know, and making conclusions out of it. Does it make sense? I don't know if it does, yeah? But, okay, let's talk a little more about the OBE. Look, let me see if I have this here. Yes, something that we observe, and let me begin by this, I was already mentioning it a little bit, is that this is a capacity. It's something that anybody can develop. It's like learning how to read, learning how to swim, learning how to ride a bicycle. It's just a matter of receiving some information, practicing a little bit, and normally it takes about, I would say the average about 2 to 3 months, you know, when the person starts having their OBEs. I have seen students that they do it in 2 weeks, but I don't want to give you the impression that that's the average. And I have seen people that it takes them, instead of 2 to 3 months, it takes them 4. So more or less the average, 2 to 3 months. It's not, learning to play the piano is a lot harder, by the way. My parents paid so much money when I was a teenager, and I don't know how to play anything, you know, not even happy birthday with one finger, nothing. But something else that is observed that we see about the out-of-body experience is that when we go to bed and we lie down to sleep at night, we already disconnect from the body and we basically spend the entire night floating about the body in this condition, separated maybe by about 2 to 6 inches. This varies from person to person and from night to night, really. And we all do this? Meaning, you see, if I can be more categoric or definitive here, what we see is that everybody spends basically their entire night floating above the body. Unconscious, dreaming, unaware, but outside. How can we say this? Remember that don't believe in anything? When you go and you do the historical research, you realize that everybody from different cultures, you know, different centuries, they already described this. They would say, I left my body, I saw there my husband, my wife, my daughter, my mother, whomever was sleeping close by, and I realized that they were disconnected. But when we come to the 21st century, we certainly see this, but also, and the students, you know, they control well their abilities, they also observe this. But even people in other cities, countries, you know, they also confirm the same thing. Maybe even staying within the same spirit of have your own experiences. If you leave the body tonight, and I don't know who sleeps close to you, you know, your roommate, your spouse, etc., your dog, by the way, you know, don't be surprised if you see, I'll get to this in a second, but don't be surprised if you see the person floating above their body, unaware, unconscious, like in the other image. Animals also do it, but this is rare. This is rare to see, meaning an animal awake or aware outside the body. If you know what I mean, usually you just see them floating just like most humans. Yeah, but they also do it, our friends there. Now, what is interesting about this idea that we all leave the body every night, first of all, think about the amount of time that this implies that we have spent outside the body. Meaning, we sleep about a third of our day, which is about a third of our life. So about 8 hours of 24, right? Maybe nowadays, and you know, as we age a little bit more, we don't sleep exactly 8 hours, but a little bit less. But when we were babies, we used to sleep 14. Remember those days? Oh, that was so good. But anyways, on average, 8 hours of the day, a third of the day. So to put round numbers, if we are 45, we have slept 15 years. And 15 years in which basically the 15 years we have spent them floating above the body, unaware most of the time, yeah? So this means that we can draw a few conclusions from this. The first thing is, if we already disconnect every night, it means that the process of separating, of leaving the body, must not be that hard. Because we do it involuntarily, spontaneously every night. Almost like breathing, that we don't have to apply our conscious will in order for us to inhale. But it's already happening, yeah? By the same token, coming back in the morning must not be that difficult or that hard, because all of the nights of our life, we, you know, wake up and we again are using this big gorilla, as I was mentioning. And the other thing is, spending time outside the body must not be dangerous. Think about this, because we have already spent one third of our life floating above the body. So if leaving the body is not that hard, coming back is not that hard, and spending time outside the body is not that dangerous, actually it's not dangerous, what is it that we want to learn in order to enjoy this? What we want to learn, basically, is to recover the awareness, the consciousness, the moment that we are in this condition, yeah? And there are several reasons why sometimes this doesn't happen more often, you know, to more people, I mean, in society in general. One of the biggest ones, and this is no fault of ours, but still is a very big influence, has to do with classic Western education. We are just simply not taught to value what happens during the night. Think about it. What do most people want? What do we want when we go to bed at night? To sleep, to shut off, to shut down. You know, sometimes the perfect night is when we can see pitch black, you know, until the morning, right? Actually, we already start getting worried if we are lying in bed for 20 minutes and we haven't fallen asleep. We are already thinking, look, I have to sleep. I had a classic Western education, you know, probably like most of you. Even though I had out-of-body experiences, as I was telling you, since I was 12, the first time that I told my parents, they were dismissive of it. They were actually not even negative. They didn't tell me, look, go do a confession or something like that, which I know people that do it, by the way. But no, their attitude was more like, it's gonna pass, don't worry about it, you know. Don't even pay attention to it, but eat your vegetables. this was a concern of them. Yeah. So a much more practical thing is, I guess, what I'm trying to say. So because of this, you know, we normally go to bed with this intention of wanting to sleep, and this is basically what happens. I know of certain cultures in Australia and a few in Africa that when they are doing the equivalent of like our breakfast, yeah, when they are eating their morning meal, let me put it this way, it's not quite our breakfast, but when they are doing their morning meal, the parents are asking the kids, what did you do during the night? What happened during the night? And they have their own techniques and rituals and things that they pass on to the kids, but the point is the kid grows up already, you know, valuing or trying to stay aware during the night, which is something that certainly I didn't receive. For me, it was, you know, just, I would even see my sisters, you know, grab the pillow and put it on top of their head because they wanted to be undisturbed the entire night. This was my education, let's put it this way. So this is basically what happens, yeah? But probably many of you have already felt sensations of disconnection of the transitional mechanism when you were falling asleep or, you know, waking up in the morning, you know, of the disconnection. And really there are many. This that you were seeing briefly here is actually page 92 of the book, because we did a very big survey, you know, of the most common sensations that people describe when they have out-of-body experiences, which many times again occur when we are falling asleep at night and waking up in the morning. So these are also the percentages there. One of the most common ones is the falling sensation. So especially in the morning that we feel that we are, or dream that we are falling, and we wake up sometimes with like a little jerk, so to speak. Yeah, 63% of the population, you know, describes that they have that sensation. So I mentioned them so for you to see and to realize that when you have felt this, because you were feeling the transitional period, you know, as you were falling asleep or waking up. The floating sensations, some are a little bit more smooth. The myoclonia, this is a very technical medical term. Myoclonia is this like muscle spasms. You know, when sometimes we're falling asleep and our hand sort of like has a little jerk, or our leg, right? Usually happens with the extremity. Some of them can be a little bit more shocking, impactful, let's put it this way, like the catalepsy. So this is when we wake up in the morning, and probably some of you have already felt this. We wake up in the morning and we try to move our body and we can't. Our body is completely still, completely rigid. We are unable to move it. We try to scream, wake up the person next to us. Nothing works. And really it takes usually about 20 to 30 seconds until we regain the control of our physical body and we're able to move. I know that these 20 to 30 seconds, for those of you that maybe have felt the sensation, they seem like an eternity. You know, really, it's only 20 or 30 seconds, but in our mind is racing. People sometimes are thinking, look, I died because I cannot move my physical body. And of course, this creates sometimes, you know, a little bit of a block or a shock, let's put it this way. But this is, you can see that over 50% of the population feels this. Yeah, so it's not that abnormal. So if you have felt it, welcome to the club. You know, you are just like 0.5% of the population. You're not going crazy, let me put it this way. Yeah, so there are many sensations there, of course, that we can feel. Now, how, let me get to this, but afterwards, if you want, you can ask me more about the little dog and animals. But what I wanted to get to, because I think that many of you probably have already had these types, is the different types of experiences. So the most common one is the spontaneous one, the involuntarily. So in the middle of the night, for no apparent reason, we recover the awareness and we are floating close to the ceiling or, you know, close to a wall. And we can describe with detail the architecture of the wall or of the ceiling. Usually the spontaneous experiences, they tend to be short-lived, maybe 5-10 seconds. Sometimes the person has the opportunity to see his physical body in bed, and this usually surprises us even more, and we come back into the physical body. Yeah, certainly they can last, you know, 20 minutes, 15 minutes, but most of them are short because of this. Notice, by the way, that there isn't anything necessarily negative about the experience, or scary about it, or ugly about it. We really are just seeing ourselves, and we are not that ugly, right? We are a little bit, okay. But it's not this. It's the element of surprise, because we're really used to our mugshot, so to speak. So it's the element of surprise that brings us back into the physical body. Yeah. Now, this is probably the most common kind. Then we have the forced out-of-body experience. The main thing here is something that probably you have already heard of, which is the near-death experience. I'm sure that most of you probably have already read books about it, seen documentaries. Now it's becoming a lot more well-known, let's put it this way, because you have probably already read and seen documentaries about this. Just like we were describing the classical account of this, what is it that people usually describe once they come back from a near-death experience? What did they say that they saw? Not a trick question, by the way.
Light?
Yeah, a tunnel of light, right? Certainly. Maybe going a little bit in order. One of the first things that they describe is that they are able to see their body and the doctors and the nurses, right, working on their body once they are, you know, forced or taken out of their body. I'm going to say against their will, simply because they were not really trying to do it. It just happened, and there are many causes of this, right? A heart attack, an accident, anesthesia in the middle of a surgery, a drowning, really a lot of things can produce it. So the person sees his body, sees the doctors, the paramedics, the lifeguards, then it usually sees the light or a tunnel of light. It finds itself going through this tunnel or following the light, and they arrive at some other condition, dimension, plane of existence, parallel world, whatever name we might want to use to refer to that, right? And over there are a few people there to meet them, to greet them. Sometimes among those individuals that can vary in size, you know, can be 2, can be 20, can be 10, they're able to recognize certain relatives of theirs that had already passed through the transition of death, right? So the grandmother is there, the uncle is there, etc., etc. Also among that group, there seems to be one that is like, a little more proper, like the one in charge of the little group, really is their spirit guide. And this is usually the one that does most of the talking. And he tells them in few words, sometimes actually in a lot of words, it seems like it's a discussion of a couple of hours, but most of the times the end result is, it's not your time, go back. The person finds himself going through the tunnel into the physical body again. So the classical near-death experience. Of course, there are a lot of things that vary. Whom did we meet? Why did the person was forced outside his body? What did the spirit guide say? What was the color of the light? A, B, C, D. But one of the most interesting things about the near-death experience, and I'm sure that you have already seen this effect, and this actually goes to the heart of, you know, a practical manual for exploration and personal evolution, is how much do these individuals change after their near-death experience in terms of their personality, in terms of who they are. I'm sure that you have seen this. They themselves, they say, look, I'm a much better person after that. Not that they were bad people, not necessarily. It's just simply that they become a lot more effective, grounded, assistential, helpful. And there's really a list of things that most of them usually describe or show, you know, after the near-death experience. And by the way, this is the same thing with the out-of-body experience, for sure. But, for example, first of all, most of them become much more humane. They try to help other people more. This is good, right? We know that the world would be a much better place if more of us, I mean, society, right, more of us who were thinking about helping others than otherwise, yeah? So, this is good. Another thing is, these individuals, most of them lose the fear of death. This is also good, of course, but this is not as simple as it sounds, just losing the fear of death. Let me see if I can take 30 seconds, a minute here, to talk a little bit more about this. And the reason is because, notice how we normally don't talk about death ever, right? And death is a little funny. When we are younger, sometimes we don't think about it too much. But as the decades start to pile up, we still don't talk about it, but it starts to take more of our mental time and space because we have to try to make sense of that reality. There is a line of psychology that explains this a little better, that sometimes beside the fear of death, we have, you know, some insecurities, little phobias, some fears that sometimes are not so little, that originate from this basic fear. The fear of death, the fear of dying. And what happens is that when these individuals lose the fear of death, all of these other things have also no reason for existing, and they also drop. And then the end result is that the person becomes a lot more open, authentic, spontaneous, much more grounded, much more courageous to a certain extent, basically much more effective. Yeah, sometimes many things maybe individuals don't do in the course of their life because in their mind, you know, that might be a little hard, or that is not going to go well with a certain, with my family or with my population, or, you know, with a certain sector of the population. But afterwards, they are a lot more uninhibited in a positive sense. Yeah, I don't mean, you know, crazy, teenager crazy. I mean in a positive sense. This is good. And notice how this is hard to measure, to quantify, to put a dollar amount or, you know, some type of number to it. But the person realizes, look, I am a lot more effective, much more confident at the same time. Yeah. Now another thing, most of these individuals, when they come back, it seems that they come back with more energy. They want to live, they want to accomplish things, they want to realize, execute things. And this happens because of something very specific that we were already hinting at the beginning. While they are in a near-death experience, usually their spirit guide gives them some hints about their life task, about their life purpose. And then they come back with a greater sense of direction, of course. And then they want to live, you know, they really want to do X, Y, and Z, etc., etc. This is also good. Yeah. A little bit like what we were mentioning at the beginning, just to, you know, keep on going here. Notice how all of these benefits come to this person who has one near-death experience. So not planned, traumatic, not ideal, not well understood. Sometimes it leaves consequences on the physical body. But even then, the person becomes so much more better. They realize that. So instead of a near-death experience, what could we expect, for example, not from one near-death experience, but from 5, 10 years of out-of-body experiences? Knowing where we're going to go, you know, healthy, planning them, you know, without any consequences or medical bills afterwards, this would scare me. You know, the rest, no, but the medical bill, yes. So, you know, the potential again is big, you know, with regards to this. I promise in the book and also in the classes, we won't try any near-death experiences. They're all going to be down here, okay? The provoked at will. This one is the least common of the three. A big reason for that is because even though this information is not new, it has existed, you know, since man invented writing or painting. There are actually even paintings in caves of, you know, the astral body leaving the body. So this is nothing new. But, you know, in our Western Hemisphere for many centuries, this belonged to groups that were a little bit more exclusive. And then the information wasn't as accessible to everybody. More occult, esoteric, hermetic, you know, secretive, etc., etc., etc. Yeah? I don't mean to say that they were wrong by being occult or secretive. I think that you see the reason why they were occult, right? What would happen if we were in the Middle Ages and here I was with the best of my intentions trying to give an open, free lecture about out-of-body experience? I think you realize why I, well, but also you that came to the lecture would like to keep this a little more secret so that nobody else knows. Yeah, you couldn't even study physics back then. Talking about conventional science, we say nowadays in the 21st century, of course, this is not necessary. So we can, you know, study the out-of-body experience in a very direct fashion. You know, the same way we study biology, nutrition. If we eat this and this happens. If we eat that, this and that happens. If you do this technique, this and this happens. If you do that, that and that tends to happen. Yeah? Now, how do we have the OBE? There are many ways. There are many, you know, ways of doing it. I actually have in the book, you know, an entire chapter, you know, designed for how to. A lot of different types of techniques, and the reason why this is good is because what we see, you know, from the classes and from giving, you know, lots of classes to different people is that we are all very, very individual. And then what works with me doesn't necessarily work with the person next to me, and what works with them doesn't necessarily work with me. So we are not like computers that we can install, you know, Windows on everybody. So because we're so individual, you know, it's good actually to try them all at least once or twice so as to see which one is going to work better, and then to stay with that one maybe for like 2 or 3 weeks, so that we really control it and, you know, master it. You know, like anything in life, when we do something the fifth time, we are much better than when we did it the first time. And when we are doing something the 20th time, we're better than when we did it the fifth time. And when we're doing something the 100th time, we're better than when we do it the 20th time. Yeah. So it's a matter of practice, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But one of the techniques that I actually wanted to give you here, because you can practice it at home already, that is not on chapter 4, but it's actually on chapter 2. So there are like 10 pages dedicated to this that can already help you to have OBEs. I think I missed that image. Yes, but that's okay. It's called the VELO. The name is a little technical. VELO is an acronym for Voluntary Energetical Longitudinal Oscillation. Don't worry about that. You don't need to memorize that. Just in the practice, what is it that we do? What you do is go to a place as if you were going to do a meditation. What I mean to say is undisturbed, you know, that there isn't going to be big noises around or the TV, you know, next to you. But just simply, you know, more undisturbed. And then either sitting, standing, or lying, you know, on a mat or on a bed, we're gonna start to focus on our energies inside, and we're gonna start to move our energies inside our body from the head running down towards our feet, from the feet towards the head, from the head towards the feet, towards the head, towards the feet. As always, the fifth time we're better than the first time, the 100th time we're better than the 20th. But probably by the fifth, the third, the sixth time, you're already gonna start to feel this flow. And then as you start to increase the speed of it, you're going to reach a resonance condition that is called the vibrational state. You're going to feel these vibrations inside. These vibrations, let me see if I can get back to this, I think. These vibrations are something that people have described, you know, for the longest that we feel when we are having out-of-body experiences. I just want to get back to this. Actually, about a third of the population describes, you know, feeling the vibrational state or vibrations in general before leaving the body. So this would be a technique for inducing the vibrations so as from there to induce the out-of-body experience. Why would this be so effective? Because of the following. When we are close to the physical body, we have all of these energetic connections that connect the two bodies, the physical body to the astral body. When we start to separate a little bit further from the physical body, maybe about 3 or 4 feet, I'm thinking here in meters, so maybe about a meter, 3 to 4 feet, all of these energy connections start to group themselves into one main one that, you know, historically has been called of the silver cord. Have you heard this name before? I'm sure probably most of you. So, but before, you know, the silver cord forms at a distance of about 3 to 4 feet, we have all of these like mini silver cords. And if these energies are more flexible, are more loose, then controlling the disconnection becomes easier. But if these energies are a little bit more rigid or more stuck, then it becomes a little bit harder to have OBEs. Now, we know that even though quite a number of people have OBEs, this is not the most common thing in society. So it means that most people must have their energies a little bit more rigid, out of shape, stuck. And then the question would be, why? Because the answer is what it helps us to, you know, start to control and develop this. Really, again, it's a little bit like the answer as before. It's no fault of ours. It's just simply classic Western education. Meaning, how many friends, relatives, co-workers do you know that exercise their energetic system, that worry about it? Not because they don't want to. Notice that there is no bad intention on their part. It's just simply that, unfortunately, we didn't grow up with this knowledge. Yeah, sometimes we know it because we have, you know, taken the interest, the personal interest, to try to understand this a little bit better. So, but it's not the most common of things. So what happens is that the energies for most people, they tend to be, maybe the better term in English would be, they are rusty. Yeah, this is pretty much it. And then we need to do like energetic exercise to start to loosen up and put in good shape this energy system and mechanism so that it becomes more flexible and it allows the disconnection between the two bodies. And then the VELO that I was explaining can help you a lot towards that. you know, not only towards putting, not only is it a technique that will flexibilize and loosen up your energies and help you to get control of them, but at the same time, it's a technique that is already going to induce the out-of-body experience. Yeah? Let me give you a classic reference here that I'm sure here in the U.S., some of you are going to remember the name. Have you heard of Robert Monroe? See, this is great about the U.S., by the way. When I am giving a lecture in Brazil or in Germany, I say Robert Monroe, and they're like, Robert who? You know, they. But here, great. One of the things about Robert Monroe, and you probably know, you know, there's the Institute in Virginia, right, the Monroe Institute, and he deals a little bit more, or they deal a little bit more, I should say, with sound technology, the Hemisync, right? What is interesting about him is that he didn't use the Hemisync or the sound technology for having out-of-body experiences. But Monroe's technique for having out-of-body experience was inducing the vibrations so as to then have an out-of-body experience. Yeah, so just to give you a classic reference, I guess, of, you know, where this, you probably might have already read about these vibrations and the effectiveness, I guess, of this technique. Yeah? Now, once you start having OBEs, let me see if I can jump a lot of the slides that we already went through. This is the one, I think, that we were on. Yeah. Once you start having out-of-body experiences, you can do all sorts of things, of course. The astral body has very different properties than the physical body. We can go through physical things. This has advantages and disadvantages. So if we leave the body, of course, our room doesn't contain us, doesn't hold us. But we can go through the wall, we can go fly and go see a relative, go see whatever we want, basically. But it also has disadvantages. If we arrive at a place where there is a very interesting book and we want to open it and read it, what happens is our hands go through it. And you cannot flip through it because you cannot grab anything. Yeah? So advantages and disadvantages of, you know, the abilities of the astral body. There are many things that you can do. Let me see if I can give you at least some examples. In the book I have, you know, it's not just a how-to manual, but I also have like 10, 12 different accounts that are going to help you to, you know, illustrate. Some of them are mine, but others I actually pick of several of my colleagues so that, you know, they would exemplify a little bit better, you know, what we were describing at that moment. But, for example, just like our hands and our entire body go through anything that is physical, something that is interesting outside the body is that your senses also go through physical things. So my hand can go through the wall, but if I wish, I can stay in this relative position and I can focus my sight, let's say, you know, 100 feet in this direction. And it doesn't matter how many walls there are in between, I am seeing, you know, the store on the other side of the block and what is happening over there without having moved from here. So my senses also go through physical things. I don't know if you realize that this that I am describing here, this ability of the astral body that I am describing here, is what physically usually people call of remote viewing. Yeah? Now, remote viewing is the typical classical ability to see of the astral body. It's the normal. What happens is that inside the body, it's not that easy to use it because the physical body restricts us. So, you know, we need to train ourselves a little bit in order to start to use this ability of the astral body as we are inside the body. But outside the body, this is normal. So if all of a sudden I cannot find my wallet, I can start to look inside my office and my office desk. Ah, that's where I left it. Okay, tomorrow I'll pick it up. But I don't necessarily need to have moved. Yeah? Let me actually even tell you something else. Maybe this will help illustrate a few things. When I was 19 or so, I was already having, at least I had already had a number of OBEs, but I didn't understand everything well yet. And I studied chemistry mainly because I wanted to go to medical school. Really, this was my initial objective. But I knew that when I got to medical school, I didn't have a rich uncle, you know, or a rich father by that token. So my plan was, when I get to medical school, I'm going to go to classes. I'm going to work the other, you know, 16 hours because I'm really going to need to. And then when am I going to study? My thought was, at night, I can leave the body and study at night outside the body. I already knew that I couldn't grab the book because I had already tried it and flipped it and, you know, read it. But I also knew that my vision would go through physical things. So I thought, and actually I remember even hearing this from other people, you can focus your sight on page 50 and start reading without needing to open it. I knew that this was possible. Now what happens is, of course, one thing is the theory, another thing is the practice. The first times that I started to try this, this is so impractical, you know, because the vision outside the body is so focused, so specific, that first of all, the pages are so close together that you have to try to find in the corner page 50. And you know, just a little bit of movement and you're 10, 15 pages down or 15 pages up. You see what I mean? And once you find page 50, you have to move in the same plane to get to the paragraph that you're going to start to read. Now, this already takes a lot of time, by the way, for you to locate this. But the other thing is, practical things. The odd pages, the writing is from left to right, but the even page is from right to left. So this also complicates things. And the other thing is, us. You know when we are reading and we reach the end of a paragraph and sometimes we start thinking about something else and all of a sudden we realize that we have no idea what that paragraph said, so we reread it. You know, happens all the time. When we are doing that outside the body and we lose our concentration, now again we're 20 pages down. Now again we have to start the process for looking for the page number and trying to locate where we are. At the end, you know, in an entire OBE, maybe I had read two paragraphs. It was just so completely impractical, you know. Sometimes I joke, this is why I stayed with chemistry, you know. And I didn't go to medical school anymore. No, this wasn't the only reason, really. There were a lot of other factors, but really this is reading sometimes, especially a closed book, is very, very difficult outside the body in the very conventional sense of reading it, yeah? So, but anyways, there are a lot of different things that you can do. Let me give you another example of, you know, how the OBEs are very different. You know the idea of time? Sometimes even we simplify things and we say, look, outside the body there is no time. There is. It's just that, again, reality is usually a lot more complex than our initial simplifications or our initial, you know, ways of trying to understand things. There is time, there is cause and effect, something follows something else, etc. It's just that the concept of time is not the same concept of time that we have here, physically, inside the body. So for example, let's say that one night you leave the body and it's 11 o'clock on your alarm clock on your nightstand. And you go out and you feel that you did half an hour worth of experiences. Notice that you don't have your, you know, your watch or your iPhone with you to, you know, time it. So when you come back, the half an hour of experiences, 20 minutes went by on your alarm clock. Great. The relationship is almost 1-to-1. You don't even think twice about it. But the next night, you go out and you feel that you were out, for example, 2 hours worth of experiences. And then you come back and the same 20 minutes went by on your alarm clock. The next night, you leave the body and you feel that you were out 6-8 hours. You come back and the same 20 minutes went by on your alarm clock. On other experiences, you go out and you feel that you were out 2 days. You come back, and the same 20 minutes went by your alarm clock. So there is time. It's just that time starts to dilate, starts to lose its meaning depending on the reality, on the dimension that you go. Different dimensions have different concepts of time. Yeah. This, by the way, also helps you to have more richer experiences. Because some of them look like an entire soap opera, you know, in which you, but it's a real thing. You know, Days of Our Lives, 20 years, but compressed into 20 seconds there. And you understand a lot sometimes about the relationships that you have right now, because you see the entire soap opera that you have already had with these people, you know, for during the course of 20 lives. You see what I mean? So, for example, yeah? Now, just to summarize here, I think I'm talking too much. But just to summarize all of this, you know, why would we want to do it? I know that we already spoke about several things, so we don't need to go in detail into all of this. We spoke about elimination of the fear of death. Assistance to others is a very big thing. I wish I could, you know, have the entire month to talk about the types of assistances that we can do outside the body, helping other people. Let me at least give you one example. You know, these modalities like Reiki, that you can go and exteriorize energies to somebody else. You know, this is very good, by the way. I think that Reiki is one of those philosophies or modalities that has one of the best intentions, to help the other one. Certainly. Now, what happens when we do it physically and we are sending energies to the other person is that our physical body is restricting the sending of energies. We have to deal with the physical body that is here in the middle. So only a fraction of the energies that we're sending go out. And before they go into the energy system of the person, we also have to deal with the restriction of the physical body of the person. So only a fraction of the energies make an effect, but still, it's good, it's great. If you can do it more. No doubt. But what I'm inviting you to think is, if we are outside the body with our astral body, and a relative that maybe is needing some energy is sleeping and disconnected from its physical body, like in the other image that we were seeing, now we can go directly from our astral body into their astral body, and 100% of the energies arrive. And the assistance is deeper, quicker, more effective. Yeah? This would be one type of assistance, really, outside the body. Again, I will need the entire month, you know, to talk to you about all of the different kinds. In the book, I have several other different kinds of, you know, assistances and accounts of them. So this will give you, you know, a very good idea of the type of help that we can do outside the body. This is what, on our perspective, this is one of the best applications of any capacity. One thing is the skill. Another thing is how we use it, right? How we choose to use it to a certain extent. Now, identification of the personal existential program, or, you know, the program for this life, for this existence, life task that we were describing before. Increase of paranormal abilities, not just the out-of-body experience, but also intuition, clairvoyance, clairaudience, precognition or premonitions, retrocognitions or recollections of past lives. All of these things start to increase because they are, to a certain extent, paranormal, parapsychic, energetic phenomena. Yeah? Now, access to other dimensions. Here also I would need an entire month to describe to you, you know, everything that you see. But really we become like a spiritual explorer of the spiritual planes. Notice how interesting it is, right? We are a spiritual being. This is really the momentary condition, the physical life. Yeah? So sometimes we say, you know, one of the most spiritual things that we can do is get to know directly the spiritual planes, to have experiences and observations, so that even everything that we have read that is good doesn't stay only, or that people have told us, you know, from different lectures, doesn't stay only as an idea or as a theory, but now we can, you know, access it, live it, verify it, you know, expand on it. Actually, we would be very happy, you know, if more people can help us to expand that entire, you know, body of knowledge, of course. Yeah? So, and we can visit so many, there are thousands of them. You know how sometimes us as human beings, we like, how could I say, to create a lot of folklore and mysticism and legends, and it's just a big part of our nature. And I'm including myself in this, of course. So sometimes maybe you might have heard that people say, look, there are as many dimensions as petals in a rose. You see, the description is, how could I say, romantic. Actually, I prefer it. It's nicer. Sometimes it's just not as accurate. Let's put it this way. Or we like the magical numbers. They are 3. They are 11. They are 7. They are thousands of them. 30 has nothing to do with a rose or with a specific number. There are thousands and thousands of them. I don't know anybody that has maybe visited them all, to put it this way, but we really don't have to. This becomes a little bit like geography, that we don't have to have visited all the cities in the world in order to get a very good idea of the structure of the continents and the countries. So, you know, if I tell you Rio de Janeiro, you know that this is not in California. You know that this is not Europe. We already have a very good understanding of, you know, the arrangement of the structure of this. So we get a very good understanding of how the dimensions structure, in, again, with your observation. Not because somebody has told you, but because you go and you see them. Just to finish here, maybe one of the two biggest things, I think, or the one of the biggest benefits here with the OBEs, and actually I'm going to add a third one and explain all three here, is greater spiritual maturity or spiritual development, yeah? A greater understanding of cosmoethics, and I'll explain this a little bit better. And the third one that I want to add here and explain with all the other, with the other two, is meeting this evolved, benign, positive individuals that want to help us. And we have given them a lot of names, right? So we call them of masters, beings of light, spirit guides, angels, ascended masters. We really have given them so many names. So one of the biggest benefits of the Arfari experience is that we can be out and we can be consulting things with them, sort of like face to face, more or less the way we're here. And you know, if something is not clear for us, we can ask, say what, you know, come again. They will repeat it. They have so much patience. They have so much patience. And I say this because some of us, and I'm talking about me here, were a little knucklehead, and they keep on repeating it over and over until hopefully, you know, one day it's going to sink in. But for some of us, I don't want to put you in this bag, but some of us are just simply a little knucklehead. Yeah, this is really the best way of describing this. Just to summarize a huge chapter here in a few words, and there's really a chapter based on this. What they want is, they want to give us information that hopefully we're going to choose to apply in our life, and this is going to enrich our life. Really, now, trying to summarize this huge chapter in a few words, this is what they want. Of course, this means different things for different people, naturally, but this is in essence what they want. Now, something also that happens is, as we are interacting with them, we start to sort of like pay attention and, you know, wonder and, how could I say, compare, what is it, what are the attributes that they have so developed that makes them what they are that I don't have at that moment? And the reason why we start to do that is because we start trying to see, look, what things can I, how could I say, what examples can I grab from them that I can incorporate in my life that are going to help me to start to become just a little bit better? Of course, overnight, you know, I'm not going to be that, but little by little, we start improving. So they can be, you know, our references. I don't know if you would agree all with me here, but let's think about this. Who are usually the models, the idols for most people in society? Who do they look up to?
Rock stars.
Yes, musicians. Actors, actresses, athletes, right? And by the way, I don't mean to say that they don't have a good skill. They do. Of course, that's the reason why they are at the top of their field. But, you know, that doesn't mean, the fact that they have that skill so developed doesn't necessarily mean that they are references of, you know, spiritual development or spiritual maturity, if you understand what I mean. If that guy can hit a little white ball like a god and make it go into a little hole, you know, I don't know how many feet away, he's good with that, great, but he's not a reference of spiritual maturity. We know that, if you understand what I mean. But people sometimes get confused, and they want to be like that person, yeah? I guess what I'm inviting you here to think is the following. More directly, more specifically, your own model of spiritual development can be your own spirit guide. Because now we can access them more directly, more specifically, and not indirectly, not because, how could I say, because of what I left when I drank tea or coffee, which it's a way sometimes of communicating, but it's a little bit more indirectly and harder to read, but it can be very clear, very direct, yeah, very realistic, like us right now, yeah? Now, the other thing that also helps us to grow a lot is as we start understanding this a little bit better. Let me see if I can take just a couple of minutes of explaining this of cosmoethics. One of the things that goes very hand in hand with spiritual maturity and spiritual development is precisely the degree of ethics, of correctness that a person has. Now, all of us, we have a certain idea of what is right or wrong already inside of us. What is interesting is when we compare, for example, what we think that is right or wrong, let's say with our parents, we realize that there are small differences. And when we compare what we think, our values, our ethics, what is right or wrong with our children, we realize that there are some differences there as well. And you know human nature. We tend to think, everybody tends to think, I am the right one. But my old man, he, you know, he's past his time. And my young kid, no, he doesn't have enough experience. But they are thinking the same thing. The young kid is thinking, look, no, my old man and my grandfather, oh, forget about it. they don't even know what I am going through. And the grandfather is thinking the same thing, of course, about the other two. What does this say about us? This says that a lot of our, how can I say, values and ethics are very influenced by the life and the decade in which we grew up in. Of course, our references, it's very hard to escape our references. Now, I guess part of what I'm also inviting you here to think is that the moment that you leave your body and you meet the spirit guides, you realize that their level of ethics and their criteria are not based on one country or one culture or one century, but their criteria are more cosmic, universal, and we start to incorporate that into us as much as we can. As much as we can, because really it's hard to keep up with them. And we're not supposed to. You know, we go at our own pace, of course. But we start understanding much better this of cosmoethics. And this also, you know, as much as we can, helps us to develop, to be better people, if that makes sense. Yeah? But okay, let me stop over here, just so as not to go the entire night, and also because, as I was mentioning before, you know, I wanted to give you a good 20 minutes there for Q&A so that you can ask whatever you want about out-of-body experiences. By the way, in other lectures they were asking me about Obama and about why the sky is blue, and I was like, look, this is not about that. I can answer. I can give you the reason why the sky is blue, but let's try to stay within the out-of-body experience, okay? Or, you know, this type of topic, yeah? Questions? Can I help you with something? You know, actually, look, even as we go through the questions, let me pass this around. This information that you receive of our calendar of activities, if you want to receive our calendar of activities, and we come to the Bay Area maybe 3 times a year or so, or 2, 3, 4, then just put your name, email address there, and we'll let you know, when we come. Yeah, so that you can come. So let me do this. Let me give this here, and you can pass it around, and then, you know, back there, they can also pass another one around. But yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay. A while back, a few years ago, I was really very deeply interested in this subject, and I was trying to learn how to do it through books and talk and stuff like that, and I was really trying every night, and I was doing what they said to do and all that, and I was having such a hard time, and I was getting really frustrated, but I tried and tried and tried and tried. And finally, in my meditation, I thought I heard guidance say that I wasn't supposed to do that, that I was needing to learn how to be in my body.
Right.
So I'm just wondering if you have any perspective on that.
It could be, you know, your specific case. Usually what I see is that most individuals, especially when you start having out-of-body experiences, this even helps you to stay a little bit more grounded, so to speak, because you get like a balance of understanding or of having experiences that are more spiritual, and then afterwards in also understanding very well the value of the physical reality, really of being here and doing things here right now. So sometimes we say that the physical life is a little bit like a kid going to school. So the kid goes to school, learns, you know, and then at the end of the school day he goes back home and then prepares the homework, hopefully, for the next school day. So it's more or less like that. We have a life, and at the end of the life, or we are having experiences and learning, we don't stay here, but we go back home, hopefully we prepare the homework for the next school day. And through successive school days, we go on developing and everything. So it depends on what is the intention of the person inside. But the idea would be to leave the body so that we can enrich our life, and we come back here to the school where at this moment is where we're supposed to be, you know, learning. Because think about it. What would we call a kid that at that moment he should be in school but doesn't want to stay in school? He's like trying to cut class. I guess what I would say, right, and probably what we would say, look, that's not the most mature of positions, yeah? But this is probably because of the initial, how could I say, idea and intention that the person has for leaving the body, yeah? So normally, when people start leaving the body, they develop this very good balance. You know, you go out, you see, etc., but you are here, you know, still keeping up with your FICO score that we have to, you know, and, you know, worrying about transportation and, you know, our more personal relationships and things like that. And I say this because something that is very common, and maybe it might have already happened to some of you, sometimes people leave the body and they realize, outside the body, I don't need to eat. I don't need to worry about transportation. I don't need to go to work. I don't need to breathe. I don't feel heat. I don't feel cold. So sometimes the conclusion is, look, I want to stay here. I don't want to go back, you know, Monday morning to that boss that really doesn't understand me, you know. I stay here. We can't. Even if we want, if we try, if we fight to stay outside the body, there is like an energetic mechanism that after more or less after 20, 25 minutes physically, it brings you back into the physical body. Even if you don't want to, by the way, this is good because sometimes people think, what if I am not able to come back and I get lost? This also won't happen. Even if you try to stay there, you will come back. Even if you don't want to, you'll see. Actually, there's a section in the book where I'm explaining, you know, why is it safe, yeah? But, so I say this, I guess, to try to give you some ideas for you to see there what was our initial intention with leaving the body. Because sometimes for certain people really is, look, I want to escape this reality. Because physical life is really not that simple, right? Not that easy. But if we learn to, how could I say, to, or if we have the proper perspective, it can be a very good tool, and we stay at the same time very much here, you know, concerned with the things that we are doing here, and, you know, trying to advance with the things that we are doing here. So does it make sense? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a little other question that it brought up for me, though, was that one thing that I think I might have experienced years ago. I mean, because I had a lot of experiences growing up.
Yes.
But I mean, not out of body, but other things. Anyway, I'll put that. But one of the things that I think I got afraid of is that when you go out of the body and you become aware of these other realities, other beings that become aware of you.
Yes.
And sometimes they may not have such a good
level of ethics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, what's your experience with that?
Yeah. No. The question is perfect. And look, again, in the book, I have an entire chapter to talk about this non-physical consciousnesses. Let me see if I can be as realistic as possible with this. Let's think about who are the individuals who are in these other planes. They are the people that passed away from the physical reality in the last 6 months, 2 years, 20 years, 50 years. Good people pass away, but less than ethical people pass away, and they're all there. By the way, they're all there. Normally, when you have out-of-body experiences, you have the tendency to go to a range of dimensions that has, how could I say, with whom you tune into. So we have a certain level of development, of ethics, of correctness, and we have the tendency to go to a range of dimensions that is close to ours. It's actually very hard for us to go into the ones that are less developed than ours because we are not that. By the same token, it's very hard for us to go to the upper dimensions because we are also not that. So as much as I like to think that I'm good, I'm not better than what I am, and I'm also not worse than what I am. Does this make sense? So normally, it's very hard for you to bump into these individuals outside the body, to these ones that you're describing, you know, the ones that have a lower degree of ethics. Let me see, again, if I can explain it in this fashion. Let's think about this. Look, think about a common thief, okay? I say a common thief because I'm sure that all of you can think of things that are much worse than a common thief, but we don't really need to go there. I don't even want to bring the example of much worse than that. But think about a common thief. So follow me, be a little patient with me and follow me here with this example. A common thief, he thinks, his philosophy in life, if he were to write it down, I don't know, is, look, I need to steal things from other people that have earned them justly or correctly. Now, think about it. How many times have you had that idea? Probably never. This is just to show you how far away we are in terms of ethics and maturity with just simply a common thief. And this is why it's so hard to find them outside the body and to resonate with them. Because outside the body, part of the reason why there are many dimensions is because these are all the spiritual levels, so to speak, of information and everything. So it's very, very hard to find know, to bump into these individuals. Very, very hard. You bump into them sometimes more when you eventually decide to start to do assistance, help. Because then again, think about it. Where do we go when we do assistance? We don't do it, you know, I don't know the area so well here of the Bay Area, but let me use Los Angeles as a reference. We don't go to try to do assistance or to try to feed the homeless in Beverly Hills. In Bel Air, if you understand what I mean. But where do you go? You go to the neighborhoods that are a little more rough, where there is a little bit more need, and then yes, you go to those places and you see them. But in those cases, you always go with your spirit guide. They're usually the ones, you know, controlling or organizing, you know, the assistential trip, to call it this, yeah? So it's very hard to find them. What I can tell you is the physical dimension is a lot more scary than the OBE reality. Sometimes I say when I moved to LA, maybe this is the reason why you guys are up here. In the first year that I was in Los Angeles, my car stereo was stolen 3 times. You know, and in good neighborhoods. I don't know how well you know Los Angeles, but this was in Westwood, which is close to UCLA. It's actually a very nice neighborhood. The other time was in Los Feliz. I don't know how many of you know. And the other time was, now I don't even, Santa Monica, I think it was. It was in Culver City. If you ever go to visit us in Culver City, the police department in Culver City is so good. Don't run any red lights, you know, don't make any wrong turns, because they are there, okay? So in Culver City, it doesn't happen. But, and I give this as an example, that outside the body, with years of experiences, I never had this type of invasion of my privacy or of things outside the body. But inside the body, the physical dimension is very democratic. We are all at the same level, and we all have 24 hours a day. So if we go to see a movie, and the theater is packed, who is the person with whom we are playing these games of who puts the elbow in the armrest? You know what I mean? The moment that they get distracted, we put it there. And then now that the person is trying to get back at putting it there, we are, you know, just playing it cool, and I'm not going to move. But who is this person? Could be anybody. Yeah, but outside the body, this level of proximity doesn't occur. Everybody's like stratified in their dimension. Yeah? So here, I'm much more afraid of where my wallet is than outside the body. Outside the body is easy. Yeah? What else? Well, go ahead, man. Yeah.
In shamanic journeying,
yes.
They always say that you shouldn't help someone else unless you get their permission. Is that true with this as well?
No, not necessarily, because what happens is that sometimes you have cases. This is the complexity of life, I would say, of reality, that is very hard sometimes to put, it, for all cases, hard, fast rules, even though it would make it easier for us. But for example, sometimes there are cases in which people don't know that they need help. Or there are cases that are more of an emergency. For example, just a very simple, you know, realistic thing. If a house catches fire, you know, and the person is unconscious inside, you know, the firefighters are not going to wait until they wake up and ask for help. They're going to go and, you know, take the door down and take him out. Maybe he's going to wake up afterwards. But notice how there are a lot of different cases in which sometimes, you know, you have to act. Your spirit guide will act to help you. Because, you know, there are instances in which sometimes certain hard rules don't really apply. Yeah? But this is the complexity of life. This is what makes life, I would say, interesting. And also learning to discern when is part of this learning. I know it makes a lot more sense it makes it easier if there are hard, fast rules, but there aren't. This is what's interesting about life. It's complex. We are complex. Really. Yeah? What else? Was everything clear enough, I guess? Mm-hmm. Cannot believe it. Go ahead.
I have a personal question for you.
Go ahead.
About your experience here in the body, has it grown to be more positive? Do you enjoy life more? Do you think because of having these experiences or less? What's your relationship?
No, I enjoy life so much, really, so much. And look, I'm no different probably than most people in the sense that which of us had a childhood of a bed of roses, let's put it this way. I'm sure we all had a lot of challenges, and, you know, I don't want to necessarily start to tell you all my difficult stories, you know, but I definitely enjoy life quite a bit. Now, in my case, because I've had this question before, something that is interesting is that I started having them when I was 12. So I really cannot compare my life like a before and an after, because I always had them, yeah? But even then, at this moment, it's hard for me to think how my life would be if I wouldn't have had the out-of-body experiences. As opposed to, for example, other colleagues of mine, because we have instructors, you know, at ISC and researchers that they're a little bit like me in the sense that they started having OBEs spontaneously when they were younger, but we have others that they were actually students first, and they developed so well their out-of-body experiences that now they are, you know, giving classes and taking notes sometimes, you know, from them. And they, yes, they have a very specific thing with regards to, you know, the before and the after. Experiences that sometimes are, look, it's because usually my intention is not to try to awe people, but just to try to give them something here that is interesting. I have this friend of mine who had started developing his out-of-body experiences, this already some years ago, and when he was outside his body, he saw this little kid that looked, you know, in a very specific fashion and everything, and he got the intuition outside the body, look, this is going to be my son in a few years. And then he came back to his body and he told his wife, we're going to have a boy. Not now, don't get worried, but we're going to have a boy. He's going to be like this, like this, like this, like this. And the wife said, ah, yeah, sure. But a few years later, the kid was born. When he started to grow, the wife started to realize, look, it's exactly the way he had said. And this experience, you know, when he's OBE, just completely transformed the person from being a little bit more, how could I say, materialistic and, you know, a very 9-to-5 job, which, by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that he was more than a 9-to-5, he was more like a 9-to-9, if you understand what I mean, like a workaholic type of a thing, into, you know, being a lot more humane, trying to help people more and everything. So I know of a lot of these cases. In my case, I had them since I was young, so yeah. There hasn't been a before or an after. There have been many experiences that have, how could I say, helped me to refine myself, helped me to be more patient with people. I think that maybe this is something that all of us, we always, you know, could learn more, but I think maybe I was a little on the back of the class and I had to catch up with those types of things. So certainly I have seen that, and that those types of things have helped a lot. Other things, for example, I've had experiences in these dimensions where you plan your life. And then when you arrive there, this works a little bit, you know, like when you are driving in the, you know, in your car and you start hearing an old song from high school. And then the moment that you start singing the song, you also start remembering everything about that period. In which school you were, what was the name of your, you know, chemistry teacher in my case, or your English teacher, you know, and who you were dating, and where did you used to live, and what was the name of your dog, all of these things. So when you arrive there, you start remembering, before I was born, I was here, and I was thinking about doing this and that, and I was worried on whether this was going to work out when I was already there physically. And then the thing that you remember is, and I remember that these other people were supposed to be there helping me. And some of them nowadays, they're your friends. They're there, but you know, they are not doing what they should be doing. And then you start wondering, notice that there are no half, hard, fast rules. Do I say something or do I not? Am I the one that's supposed to say it? But this sometimes inside of you is difficult because you would like for all of your friends and all of your relatives, you know, you would like to bring everybody along. But everybody has its own free will, right, to a very great extent. So these types of things really have made me appreciate life a lot more, the opportunities a lot more. Sometimes I say we are so millionaires, spiritually speaking, that it doesn't seem like it, but we are. We already won the spiritual lottery. How many people in the world just don't even have the time to come to a lecture to hear and study these things? And we do. But really, I know that this is a common phrase that is thrown around, but when you leave the body, you realize, wow. And like anything in terms of capacities, the more capacity you have or the more awareness you have, the more, I know we usually don't like this word, the more responsibility we have with this. I know usually we don't like this, but as a general rule, the more mature the person is, the better relationship it has with responsibility. I know in physical society, usually we're trying to see how many things we can get out of. Believe me, I am in the same boat as you guys, trying to understand all of these things and rowing just like you guys. But little by little, you start to realize, look, certain things correspond to me. I'm the one that has to go and try to help and try to do this. And, you know, and we are not supposed to save the world, no. But, you know, just things that correspond to us. These things have helped me. You know, to be a lot more responsible and, you know, more appreciative of life. Yeah. Okay. All right, very good. Then, look, let me give the word here to Rob. Thank you on my behalf, you know, for your patience, for your
I have one last question. I saw on your flyer that there are four workshops. Four classes. So you need to take all four of them, or is each of them a separate class?
Each of them is a separate one, but they go in sequence. Now, the recommended, let me see if I have this. Let me just spend here 1 minute explaining this. Here we go. So the main out-of-body experience classes are the CDP, the Consciousness Development Program, this that you're saying. So 4 weekends of 10 hours each, starting in, I don't know, you have it there, maybe a couple of weeks or so. Now, each one of these is a weekend, and they go, you know, progressively go on explaining, you know, things that are more complex and everything. On the first module, we already start with energy exercises and, you know, what happens when you leave the body, what do you see, what are the abilities. From the second module on, we begin classes that are completely practical, where we ask students to bring an exercise mat, a sleeping bag, and we lie down there, you know, to, how could I say, to try techniques so that they will effectively be able to do them and replicate them at home. And we do the follow-up. How did you do? Then try to do this in your case, try to do that, try to do X, try to do Y. Yeah. So you have there the information, and of course, you know, the book also has, you're going to see, has a lot of info. Part of the intention for the book is because I realized that very few people, even the ones who spoke Portuguese, were courageous enough to tackle these two books. It's not even an issue of courage, it's just that they are very technical, you know. And then we needed sort of like an introduction to out-of-body experiences and, you know, personal development, so to speak. So the book is going to help you quite a bit, for sure. Yeah, and you're more than invited, you know, to the classes, of course, for all of you. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much on behalf of Many Rivers.
Thank you. thank you for the opportunity. Really
great. And thank you all for coming tonight. Just a couple of things. We have a donation bowl at the rear of the store on the counter there, and we encourage people to contribute to that, which we share with our speakers to further their work, but and also retain half to help maintain this space for further events like this. Also, we have a table right there by that gentleman with the white Henley shirt, with all kinds of books, including, of course, many copies of Luis Minero's book that he's been describing tonight, as well as other books from the IAC. So I invite you to look at those, and I dare say that our author would be willing to inscribe his name if you were so inclined to ask him to do that. So thank you so much for coming tonight. Thank you. And Stuart has just reminded me that he and I will have the pleasure of interviewing Luis Minero tomorrow on our radio show, The Mystical Positivist, on Cow's Radio.